Coming up, British broadcaster Hugh Warwick gets his first tattoo. He's been chosen to represent the hedgehog. It's a prickly affair, fun yet serious, as we try to get close to nature. But first, is it science or conspiracy?
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is the world actually cooling? Are scientists involved in a conspiracy to control your life? It's a fight to the finish at the Select Committee hearing on the State of Climate Science, December 2, 2009. Chairman Ed Markey of Massachusetts at the helm, Republican Representative Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin as denier-in-chief. Caught up in the crossfire, Dr. John Holdren, President Obama's science advisor, and Dr. Jane Lubchenco, head of the National Ocean and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. This all follows the so-called Climate Gate, where emails stolen from a British climate research facility drew fanatic newspaper reports from the usual suspects at the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Times. You'll hear calls for a congressional investigation of the emails of British climate scientists. Scientists are labeled fascists and McCarthyites. I'm your referee, Alex Smith, from Radio EcoShock. When you hear that bell, I'm jumping to a new clip from the hearings. We'll be done with your audio highlights in less than half an hour, but you can download the whole hour and 40-something minutes from our website, ecoshock.org. We enter the fight in progress with Washington State Representative Jay Inslee.
And we were talking about this issue, and this young man stood up, and he was a global climate change denier, and he was having field day with some email language that he thought showed some massive conspiracy by the Trilateral Commission or something to take over the Earth. And I just said, look, if you're right, and if there's no global warming, if you're so right, what are you going to do about ocean acidification? What do you say about that? And he was silent. And that silence speaks volumes. If people over here want to deny clear science about global warming, they cannot deny the fact that the oceans are becoming acidified, that no reputable science anywhere in the world recognizes it as happening, caused by CO2 going into the atmosphere, going into solution, acidifying our oceans. So I just say the science is clear. I wish it was otherwise. Life would be easier, but this is a challenge of the ages. Thank you.
Oklahoma Congressman John Sullivan wants an investigation.
In light of the recent disclosure of emails between several prominent climatologists revealing possible deceitful manipulation of important climate data uncovered at the world-leading climate change unit at the University of East Anglia in England, I think it is imperative that we launch an investigation into this issue and re-examine all the scientific evidence surrounding climate change.
Chairman Ed Markey introduces Obama science advisor John Holdren.
Our first witness is Dr. John Holdren. He serves as assistant to President Obama for science and technology. He is the director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and co-chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. He was a professor at Harvard. He was the director of the independent nonprofit Woods Hole Research Center. He is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He has received the MacArthur Foundation Prize, the Genius Award. We welcome you, sir, before our committee. Whenever you are ready, please begin.
Most of the action comes later in the Q&A, but here is a clip from John Holdren's testimony.
There is and there will remain after the dust settles in this current controversy a very strong scientific consensus on the key characteristics of the problem. Global climate is changing in highly unusual ways compared to long-experienced and expected natural variations. The unusual changes match what theory and models tell us would be expected to result from the very changes in the atmosphere that we know have been caused by human activities, above all burning fossil fuels and tropical deforestation. Significant impacts on human well-being from these changes in climate are already being experienced, and continuing with business as usual in the fossil fuel burning and tropical deforestation activities that are the largest contributors to these changes in the atmosphere is highly likely to lead to growth of the impacts to substantially unmanageable levels.
Chairman Ed Markey introduces NOAA Director Jane Lubchenco.
Our second witness is Dr. Jane Lubchenco, Dr. Lubchenco is the Undersecretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere and the Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She has been a distinguished scholar on these issues. She is one of the most highly cited ecologists in the world, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and similarly a recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship, as was Dr. Holdren. We welcome you, Dr. Lubchenco. Whenever you are ready, please begin.
Lubchenco on human responsibility for climate change.
Since the IPCC process began in the late 1980s, a wealth of global scientific information has cumulatively provided stronger and stronger evidence that the Earth is warming and that humans are primarily responsible. As stated in the Global Change Impacts 2009 report, global warming is unequivocal and is primarily human-induced. This warming can be seen in increases in global average surface air and ocean temperatures, widespread melting of snow and ice, rising sea levels, and changes in many other climate-related variables and impacts. Most of the observed increases in global temperatures since the mid-20th century are due primarily to human-induced increases in concentrations of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. When I served on the very first National Academy of Sciences study on policy implications of global warming in the 1980s, we talked about what human-induced climate change might look like at some point in the future. Today, we know that it's happening now. We are already seeing the effects of climate change on our landscapes, our neighborhoods, our farms, as well as our forests, oceans, and mountains. We are able to measure these changes through significant advances in our observing systems over the last 20 to 30 years, many of which are the result of NOAA's responsibility and innovation, and through collaborative global and national efforts to provide systematic and widespread monitoring of the climate system and associated environmental and social changes. As a result, we have a much better understanding of present and expected impacts of climate change. Widespread climate change impacts are occurring now and are expected to increase. I emphasize that climate change is not a theory. It is a documented set of observations about the world. A key element of the U.S. Global Change Research Program emphasizes the importance of multiple independent analyses and data sets to quantify uncertainties. And therefore, we have the benefit of this policy when it comes to global change analyses. The NOAA data used in the IPCC report are open and available, openly available. They are used heavily in the IPCC results of temperature change, similar to other major global data sets maintained by other U.S. agencies, such as NASA, and that maintained by other countries, such as the United Kingdom. So what are these data sets? What do these observations tell us about climate change? What do we know with certainty about trends to date, and what do we think is highly likely in the future? Global average sea surface temperature has risen by 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900 and is projected to rise another 2 to 11.5 degrees by 2100. The current atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration is estimated at around 385 parts per million, which is higher than the highest point in the last 800,000 years. Temperatures in the next couple of decades will be primarily determined by past emissions of greenhouse gases, but increases thereafter will be primarily determined by future emissions. Current observed global emissions of carbon dioxide emissions are beginning to exceed even the upper range of the 2007 IPCC scenarios. There is strong agreement and much evidence that with current climate change mitigation policies and related sustainable development practices, global greenhouse gas emissions will continue to grow over the next few decades. As we continue to learn more about the climate system, I would like to reiterate the importance of looking at the Earth system holistically and understanding the interconnected nature of the ocean, atmosphere, and terrestrial systems. In particular, I want to emphasize the importance of continuing our work to better understand the oceans and the potential impacts of climate change on them. I believe we've been championing the notion that we do not have but urgently need a strong focus on ecosystem-based science to inform decisions about adapting to climate change. An ecosystem-based approach also provides a broad array of possible tools for adaptation to climate change. Climate change interacts with and exacerbates other changes ranging from overfishing to nutrient pollution to invasive species and habitat destruction. Removing one or several of these stresses is likely to enhance the resilience of the system to other stresses. Equally important is the need to acknowledge that we are likely to see surprises as human actions disrupt many fundamental biogeochemical and ecological processes. The now routine appearance of dead zones, areas of low or no oxygen, on the coasts of Oregon and Washington during the summertime is an example of an unanticipated change with possibly serious consequences. What does managing with the expectation of surprises look like? These are rich areas for future research and management alike. And finally, ocean acidification, which I call the equally evil twin of climate change, provides yet another major threat to coastal and ocean ecosystems. Getting a better handle on rates of change in ocean chemistry and the consequences to marine biota are high priorities. The seemingly persistent hypoxic events off the Pacific Northwest coast and this increasing corrosiveness of the water because of acidity are two examples of potential consequences from increasing CO2 in the atmosphere. In addition, climate change can exacerbate other human-induced stresses to aquatic systems, such as those caused by nutrient loading, invasive species, and overfishing. As water resources are stressed, coastal areas are at increasing risk from sea level rise, inundation, and storm surge. North Atlantic fish populations are shifting north due to warmer oceans, and the threat to human health increases due to heat stress, air quality, and waterborne diseases. We must continue to enhance our scientific capacities, including research, observation, modeling, predictions, projections, and assessments, to ensure that we are providing policy and decision makers, planners, and the public with the best possible science-based information to take on the challenges and opportunities posed by climate change.
That was NOAA's Jane Lubchenco. Here's another clip later in her testimony.
Ocean acidity has increased by 30% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, just over 200 years ago. This increase is 100 times faster than any change in acidity experienced by marine organisms for at least 20 million years. By the middle of the century, it's expected that coral calcification rates will decline by a third, and at that point, erosion of corals will outpace new growth, making many coral reefs unsustainable. And by the year 2100, vast areas of the ocean, ultimately shown here in red, will have reached levels of acidification where pteropods, corals, and other important marine species will likely be severely compromised. So in conclusion, our understanding of the impacts of ocean acidification is relatively new. Roughly two-thirds of the published research has come to light since 2004, which is why you probably haven't heard a lot about this issue. Thanks to Congress's action in passing the Federal Ocean Acidification Research and Monitoring Act, more attention will be given to this subject, particularly by scientists at NOAA and our partners at the National Science Foundation and in academia. Nonetheless, our fundamental scientific understanding of the basic chemistry of ocean acidification is sound. More CO2 emitted into the atmosphere will increasingly lead to more CO2 being absorbed by oceans. That will make oceans more acidic. And we are now beginning to understand the ocean's very capacity to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere is being degraded by ocean acidification. These mechanisms can only be addressed by decreasing the amount of CO2 that enters the atmosphere. The dramatic impacts that ocean acidification can and will have on marine ecosystems are clear. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Markey and Lubchenco, is there global cooling?
Dr. Lubchenco, there's been a series of stories going around making the rounds that the planet is actually not warming but cooling, and that evidence over the past decade indicates that we're in a cooling period and not in a warming period historically. What would your response to that be?
If you look carefully at the climate records, the warming that has occurred is not gradual. It's jerky. And you get periods of time where there are steep increases and other times where it's relatively flat, other times where there are slight dips. And the key point here, I think, is to really understand global trends. You need to look at long enough periods of time that you get a clear signal. It is quite possible to have a decade in which you see very little change, but if you look at the entire century, you see some remarkable changes.
Wisconsin Republican Jim Sensenbrenner attacks climate science as an international fraud.
Expired. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Wisconsin.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to the emails that ended up being placed in the public record. And I don't want to get to whether or not they were legally placed in the public record. The question is whether or not they were accurate. Because if they were accurate, it's profoundly disturbing. And it does end up putting into question all of the science of climate change. Now, the data from the climate research unit at the UEA in England is one of only three major data sets, but they considerably overlap. And they've been used as a basis for the IPCC report as well as the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And that means that these two booklets that were passed out this morning, you know, at best need to have a thorough review in the light of this information that has been disclosed. And at worst, it's junk science, and it is a part of a massive international scientific fraud.
Here is more from Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner.
There's increasing evidence of scientific fascism that's going on, and I think as policymakers who are making decisions about the state of the American economy for the next several generations, that we ought to have accurate science, and it appears there's enough question on whether the science we have is accurate. You know, say that there's an awful lot of scientific McCarthyism, meaning name-calling, going on, because I quote from your email of October 13, 2003, saying, doing this will reveal that Soon and Bali Yunus are essentially amateurs in the interpretation of historical and paleoclimatology.
Washington State's Jay Inslee asks top American scientists if they are part of a conspiracy.
It is continuing studying to me that people can sit and watch the evidence before their eyes of what the seas are going to look like in a century that might melt pteropods and somehow blow that off and be more interested in emails from London. It's interesting to me. And the only way I've been able to understand it is that some people believe there's a massive global conspiracy that's intent on world domination associated with phonying up information about pteropods and the fact that the Arctic is melting. So I just want to ask you if you're part of that massive international conspiracy. Are either one of you members of the Trilateral Commission, Spectre, or Chaos? I just need an answer.
Congressman Inslee, I am not a member of any of those organizations, and I do not believe that there is a conspiracy. It would be an amazing thing indeed if the academies of science of virtually every country in the world that had one, and if the Earth and Planetary Sciences departments in every major university that had one around the world were all engaged together with the United Nations Environment Program, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and all the other bodies that have reviewed this matter in a conspiracy. That really defies imagination that the great bulk of the scientific community all around the world looking at these matters has come to the same conclusion.
Well, I'll just tell you how I look at this. The National Academy of Sciences has looked at this in great detail, in great summary, from a wide variety of data sets, not just from the individuals who wrote the emails, but in fact from a wide variety of data sets, including information generated by NASA and NOAA and a whole host of United States agencies. And they concluded that, in fact, both there are changes in the atmospheric climate and that there is increasing acidification, or at least NOAA has, associated with CO2. If that is true, isn't it fair to categorize, as much as we want to get people to use the right language in their emails, that this is a tempest in the teapot coming out of England?
Inslee thinks that reality is actually worse than climate science reports.
I have some concerns about the state of our science that are reflected in the fact that everything that I'm reading suggests that the predictions were not sufficiently dire as to what we're experiencing. Now, I am not a scientist, as you are, but it seems to me the evidence that I am seeing coming in, I'm looking at this Copenhagen Diagnosis Report I made reference to in my opening statement, that the Arctic ice sheets are melting much more fast in the summer than we anticipated, that there's been a 40% greater than average ice sheet melt than predicted in the IPCC report in 2006, that we've seen an increasing rate in sea rise than was expected. And to me, just my lay approach is the evidence seems to be coming in the last 24 months, either on the direst end of the spectrum that was considered or outside of that spectrum.
Congressman Sullivan of Oklahoma condemns the culture of corruption in science today.
Gentlelady's time has expired. The gentleman from Oklahoma, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you both for being here. I was going to ask first about the emails, too. Do you think the scandal and this seems to be a culture of corruption in the scientific community right now on these emails and manipulation of data for a purpose for to get their own results? Do you see that as a problem, yes or no?
Congressman, I don't believe that the exchanges that you saw are typical of the broader scientific community.
Science Advisor John Holdren responds.
I would add that I, too, do not believe that these emails are remotely sufficient to demonstrate a culture of corruption in the scientific community. They're emails from a relatively few people involved in a particular controversy that was attended by a good deal of frustration and anger.
John Holdren explains the carbon balance and the human role.
Well, first of all, what you need to understand is the natural flows of carbon dioxide in and out of the atmosphere. Out of the atmosphere by photosynthesis and absorption in the oceans, back into the atmosphere from outgassing from the oceans and by the decomposition or combustion of organic matter, have largely been in balance for a long time. They're currently in the range of something like 7 or 8 times the human input. But the problem is that the natural input and uptake has been in balance, and the human input has driven the system out of balance and is leading to an accumulation of additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So, this is extremely well understood scientifically. Nobody disputes this particular point.
But it's at least 7 or 8
in
times
science.
Greater than the man-made cause.
Yes, but it's in balance. It's in and out.
Now Holdren dispels the mythology around the medieval warm period.
The great bulk of scientists who've looked at these questions concluded a long time ago that the medieval warm period was a regional phenomenon and not a global phenomenon. The arguments by Soon and Balayunas to the contrary fared very badly in the scientific community in terms of the rigor and validity of their arguments. And that is the reason that they were often disparaged in discussions of this matter, in particular because they continued to espouse the view that the medieval warming period was a global phenomenon long after evidence to the contrary became persuasive to everyone else. One of the characteristics one expects of scientists is to change their mind when data and analysis show that they were wrong the first time. I changed my mind about the maximum sea level possible in the 21st century when the analysis and the data changed. And that's what we expect from others. When that doesn't happen, a degree of frustration and anger often materializes because of a concern that people are simply muddying the water by repeating discredited hypotheses.
In fact, Holdren says, we have just experienced the warmest years.
If you look at the actual temperature data, and I have in front of me the NOAA data set for the global average surface temperatures through 2008, what you see is that 9 of the 10 warmest years in the 140-year thermometer record, the period of time since 1880 when we've had enough thermometer measurements around the land and the ocean to meaningfully define a global average surface temperature. 9 of the 10 warmest years in that period occurred since 1998. 1998 itself was the second warmest year in the record. 2005 was the first warmest. All 15 of the warmest years in the 140-year record occurred since 1990. You look at the numbers, you do see a bump, as you see up there on the screen in the far right, where in the last few years there is no discernible upward trend. This is completely consistent with having natural fluctuations, natural ups and downs, superimposed on a long-term warming trend associated with greenhouse gases.
Congressman Jay Inslee makes a passionate defense of American climate scientists.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from Washington State.
Dr. Holdren, you have testified several times, listening to you, that given the extensive review by the National Academy of Science and using information based from NOAA, NASA, and a whole host of other data sets, that there is no reason to revise their fundamental conclusion that humans are contributing to change in climate, and NOAA not to change a fundamental conclusion that the oceans are becoming more acidic. Mr. Sensenbrenner suggested that there's some scientific fascism, and that's a quote. Is there any evidence of fascism in the NASA organization, scientific fascism associated with this?
Again, Obama's science man, Dr. John Holdren, denies any conspiracy.
I'm not even sure exactly what that term would mean, but I'm not aware of any cabals, conspiracies, misbehavior in the characterization and use of data in NASA or NOAA.
Well, I tell you, it's troublesome to me. The people who put the men on the moon, the people who discovered water on the moon, the people who are doing great research, figuring out how the oceans are becoming acidic, some of whom are my constituents, it's disturbing to me that people would come to this chamber and call them fascists. I got to tell you, I got a problem with that. I don't think that's right. These men and women are doing the best they can to provide us data and conclusions to the best of their ability. And they, through their professional work, have reached a very, very strong consensus on these scientific issues, who are working for Uncle Sam. And I think it's wrong to say that about them.
Speaking of science, NOAA Director Jane Lubchenco gave the committee a lesson in acidification of the oceans, complete with a steaming beaker and vinegar. Here she explains ocean acidification on the Pacific coast.
Mr. Congressman, I think the rate of change in ocean acidification has surprised many people. And it is absolutely the case that off the west coast of the United States, where winds blow along the coastline and push the surface waters away from the coast, which pulls up cold, nutrient-rich, low oxygen, and lower pH water to the surface, that's where we are seeing some of the greatest increases in acidity happening around the world. And it is of deep concern because those areas, as you well know, are historically very, very rich. Our wonderful productive fisheries off that area are in large part a consequence of this upwelling.
A frustrated Jay Inslee asks if there is any other explanation for this change in ocean pH.
I appreciate that. I want to ask, is there anybody in this room, including the two witnesses and my Republican colleagues and my Democratic colleague, is there anybody in this room who has information to suggest that the oceans are not becoming more acidic? Has anybody got information like that? Anybody? Has anybody got an explanation why the oceans are becoming more acidic other than the fact that there's massive amounts of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere? Has anybody got an explanation for that? I haven't heard any. And yet people are trying to gin up this controversy because you know why? It's not because they're not intelligent. It's because they're afraid that we can't solve this problem. And I think if we had a little more confidence in ourselves and our ability to solve this problem, we would open our minds to the scientific information that is becoming available to us.
And that concludes our time with the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. You heard selections recorded live from a webcast by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on December 2, 2009. Download the whole 1 hour and 40-something minutes as an MP3 from the climate page of our audio on-demand menu. And you'll find the quick wrap-up by Chairman Ed Markey there as well and in my blog. That's at ecoshock.org. Now you know what goes on when science meets politics. And good for you for listening.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Find all the links you need in the Radio EcoShock blog for December 3rd, 2009. We cover a lot of ugly news about the world. In fact, I've got a stack of it coming up at the end of this program. Right now, though, it's time for some important fun. People vote for what people want, but the majority of life on Earth, the animals and the plants, they don't get a voice at all, really. I'm Alex Smith, and I've often thought each member of Parliament or Congress should also represent a species, and if that creature becomes extinct, the elected member loses their seat, shall we say. Well, let's talk with broadcaster and ecologist Hugh Warwick. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, am I, Hugh?
Alex, yes, and what an absolutely brilliant idea. I think we should be tying our elected representatives to biodiversity. Absolutely brilliant idea.
Well, perhaps we'll have that kind of Parliament of the Animals at some point, and I gather you've been chosen to represent the European hedgehog.
I've been working with the Western European hedgehog as an ecologist now for over 20 years, been studying them, been finding out how much of an impact they have when they're in places they shouldn't be, finding out how well they tolerate being looked after, because they are cared for a great deal by people in the UK. And seeing really why their numbers are declining so much across the country, despite it being regularly voted the most popular animal in the United Kingdom.
And you've written a book called A Prickly Affair in Europe, and here in North America it's The Hedgehog's Dilemma. So I'm going to ask you the obvious, what is The Hedgehog's Dilemma?
I tell you what it is. It's my favorite title. Unfortunately, the publishers in the UK had other thoughts on that matter and went for A Prickly Affair. The Hedgehog's Dilemma actually comes from the work of the German philosopher Schopenhauer. And it's a simple idea that you've got two hedgehogs want to be close to each other. And as they start getting really close to each other, they start to hurt each other because they're prickles. So they move further away, and then they start getting lonely. So they try and get close to each other again. And I'd read through about the idea of the hedgehog's dilemma, and then it dawned on me that we, as a species, humanity, is in a sort of hedgehog's dilemma with the natural world. We want to be close to the natural world, or many of us do, but if we all go off and get close to the natural world, we are going to destroy it. We will trample it. We will abuse it. But as we extract ourselves from the natural world, it almost as in the opposite reaction, we remove ourselves from it. We become lonely and bereft. And there's been some very good research done showing direct physiological consequences of lack of appreciation and experience within the natural world. It's something we are designed to need.
Yes, we're hardwired for a lot of those sounds and smells and sights that we just don't get in our apartments or cities. Most of my North American listeners have never seen a live hedgehog because they don't live here on this continent. They might confuse them with porcupines, but those are different. So where do hedgehogs live?
Well, hedgehogs live most places apart from the Americas and Australia. Oh, and Antarctica, obviously. They're an old world. To use a sort of technical term, an old world species. The western reach of the hedgehog would be the west coast of Ireland, and they go all the way across to the east coast of China. And they are a very, very, and all the way down to the bottom of South Africa as well. So there are hedgehogs all over the place. We have the specific Western European hedgehog, but there are desert hedgehogs. There are ones that used to living in sort of wetter foresty areas. There are hedgehogs filling many niches. But one of the things I think is so special about the hedgehog is they are remarkably unchanged from the very first hedgehogs. And the very first hedgehogs came along in around 70 million years ago. And the mother hedgehog arriving from sort of Southeast Asia, I think they think. And that 70 million years ago is really significant because dinosaurs were around until 65 million years ago. And I had this lovely image of sort of proto-hedgehogs nipping at the heels of departing dinosaurs. But, I mean, they didn't look like our hedgehogs now. They probably didn't have spines. I mean, the spines on the hedgehog are just a wonderful adaptation. It's basically hair, which is adapted to become stiffer and stiffer and stiffer until they become a fine defense mechanism. I mean, the same style of defense mechanism as in a porcupine. But it's that great thing of convergent evolution. It's just because two things have found the same solution to a problem doesn't mean they're necessarily related. There are echidnas in Papua New Guinea and Australia, which are covered in spines. There are tenrecs in Madagascar. And obviously, you've got porcupines in Africa and the Americas. But they are all different animals to the hedgehog.
And the humble cactus, of course. Well, I've held a small hedgehog, thanks to Jimmy Hofstadter in the fifth grade, who he had one as a pet. Do they make good pets?
Well, this is a question which has been asked a lot in the UK of late, because every now and then you'll find a hedgehog breeder, a pet hedgehog breeder, will start finding some cute photographs, and they'll go out to the press, and everyone will see them, and the press will go, this is the next must-have fad pet. Now, this happened in America in the 1990s, early 1990s, about 1991, and an exotic pet dealer was in Nigeria and found these cute little hedgehogs. Now, they're different to our European hedgehogs. They're Latin names. They're a Telerix frontalis and a Telerix albiventris. They're smaller than the European hedgehogs. They've got slightly bigger, they've got bigger ears. They are almost like sort of spiny gerbils, and they do seem to make very good pets. If you are happy with the idea of having a wild animal as a pet. Now, personally, I find that too much to bear. But in the UK, my concern is that people would start getting excited and then get confused with our resident hedgehogs, which don't make good pets. And one of the simple things this comes down to is the efficiency of their kidneys. Now, I'm going to move into a slightly sort of physiological moment here. Desert hedgehogs have to be very, very careful with their water. They absorb all the water from their guts, so their feces are very dry and fairly unsmelly. European hedgehogs live in a very wet environment on the whole and are fairly profligate with their use of water, so they've got softer, smellier feces. So that's just one very good reason why the European hedgehog is not a good pet.
And you have written in your blog about a hedgehog Olympics in Denver, Colorado. Can you tell us about that?
It was something I actually thought was a joke. I really did think this was a joke. I'd been invited to the Rocky Mountain Hedgehog Show, run by the Hedgehog Welfare Society and the International Hedgehog Association, who they're the remnants of the hedgehog pet-keeping fad that swept through America and then, like all pet-keeping fads, dies a death. And there are still people very dedicated to their little hedgehogs, and they care for them an awful lot. So there was the show, which is like a sort of dog show. You've seen the film Best in Breed, or Best in Show.
Mm-hmm.
The guys who did Spinal Tap, they did a pastiche on dog shows. It was sort of like that, but with hedgehogs. You know, the cutest hedgehog wins. After quite some time. And after I'd done my talk and there'd been the hedgehog show, they said, well, you'll be staying for the International Hedgehog Olympic Games. Now, I'm prone to saying things which are lies because they're jokes. You know, it's a form of humor. And I was sort of waiting for the punchline. He didn't really think that was true, did he? But it was. And in fact, the Olympic International Olympic Committee has written to the International Hedgehog Olympic Games to ask that they ensure nobody thinks there's any endorsement from the human Olympics. And anyway, it's very different.
Please, I have to interrupt you. You must be very careful what you say, because the Canadian police want to censor everything about the Olympics. They just held a visiting journalist coming in because she might say something anti-Olympic.
What's going on with the Olympics?
Oh, well, we've got the Winter Olympics, and they've got $1 billion in police money to spend, and we don't seem to have any terrorists, so they're looking for...
Well, this is going to be great. You'll have the Hedgehog Winter Olympics then, and we can be, I don't know, I'm rolling hedgehogs down the ski slopes and seeing how fast you can get them up to.
We've got these huge icy luge things. They go a million miles a minute.
They'd love it. Well, actually, they'll probably use hedgehog skins on the original luge. In fact, I'm sure this will find this to be true. The very first people doing the luge, they used hedgehog spines on the bottom of their shoes to get traction to run. Is that true?
No. Okay. So why do people in why do the folks in Britain go to such great lengths to get hedgehogs into their gardens?
Hedgehogs, especially our hedgehogs in the UK, they eat a lot of garden pests, slugs and snails and other beasties, other invertebrates. I mean, they're insectivores is what their official title is in their terms of their how they are defined through taxonomy. But they don't just eat insects, so they're eating other invertebrates too. And they're fantastic at sort of sweeping up some of the more damaging mollusks that are out there. But also they are, and this is something I bang on a great deal about in the book, they are the one single bit of wildlife that ordinary people can have a chance to getting really close to. I mean, they can feed birds, they can throw bread at ducks in the park and things, and they can get it quite close to them. I mean, you can even eventually get a robin feeding from your hands. But the hedgehog is the one animal, because of its defense mechanism, which isn't to run away, which isn't to attack, but which is to stay still and roll up into a ball. This allows you to get very close. And once you've become attuned to the rhythm of the hedgehog and you are calm and you approach the hedgehog gently and you get the hedgehog to relax in your company, you get a chance of getting nose to nose with a genuinely wild animal, something you cannot do with any other wild animal. And I think that's really important, because so going back to the idea of how we're hardwired to need contact with the natural world, I think we can almost short-circuit that by getting a really quick glimpse of genuine wildness in the eyes of a true wild animal.
Yes, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with British broadcaster and ecologist Hugh Warwick. Hugh, some claim that hedgehogs have become a pest in the Scottish Islands or in New Zealand. What's happening in these cases?
Well, two very similar stories with very different outcomes, I'd say. In fact, I've just written a piece which should be going up on the BBC website soon about the New Zealand situation. Now, hedgehogs don't just eat slugs and snails. They will eat birds' eggs. And if hedgehogs are introduced into areas where the birds have established colonies on the ground and there weren't hedgehogs before, they can be vulnerable. These bird colonies can be vulnerable to having their eggs predated by hedgehogs. Now, I have done an awful lot of work on the islands around Scotland on this, up in Orkney, the islands, the archipelago north of Scotland, and in the Outer Hebrides to the west of Scotland. In both instances, hedgehogs have been introduced by people trying to control slugs and snails in their greenhouse. And the hedgehogs had escaped and were now causing, or being perceived to cause, problems. In New Zealand, hedgehogs were exported in the 1850s and 1860s. By the early settlers. They set up these things called the acclimatization societies. They wanted to make New Zealand, which, to all intents and purposes, was pretty darn wonderful. They wanted to make it a little bit more like home, so they imported all sorts of things, which have caused absolute chaos, such as foxes and deer and rabbits and things. But they actively imported hedgehogs. They were exporting them from the UK to New Zealand just to make people feel happier. And for quite some time, they were considered the most benign of the these imports. Now, the situations are different. In the Uists, which is the Outer Hebrides off Scotland, when these hedgehogs are found, they can be transported back to the mainland. And we don't need to kill them. But in New Zealand, there is no way you can sort of ship them back to the UK. That's obviously not feasible. Unfortunately, I find myself supporting the lethal control of hedgehogs in New Zealand, because the hedgehogs are having an impact on some very, very rare species of insect and bird, in fact, reptiles as well.
Well, I was going to say, taking them back to Britain, repatriating them, could be a really fun scene, really, when the ship arrives, I think.
Just imagine them streaming off onto the docks of Southampton. Yes, unfortunately, yes, the logistics, I think, could be a little extreme on that, as there are probably hundreds of thousands of hedgehogs in New Zealand. Interestingly, the hedgehogs on New Zealand have all sprung from limited genetic stock, and they've got slight sort of deformities in their teeth, because there was obviously a wonky hedgehog in the very early lot that went out there. So anyway, that an aside. So yes, do we have similar problems? Hedgehogs are snaffling up things they probably shouldn't be. And what was happening off the islands of Scotland is they were killing them. Yet, and then a bunch of us jumped up and down saying, maybe you shouldn't do that. And with A little bit of science. I did a study which showed you can move these hedgehogs alive, and that was great. We actually ended up having conservationists, ecologists, animal welfare, animal rights people all talking together and working together, which is possibly a first. Anyway, it's good news.
Yes, and you've said hedgehogs are impacted by climate change. How is that?
I'm not sure whether they're impacted by climate change directly. Hedgehogs are suffering from many threats in the UK, and it may be that climate change is affecting their behavior in that they're hibernating. The hedgehogs do this wonderful thing. When the winter comes, in late autumn, hedgehogs are eating absolutely nonstop, trying to put on extra body weight. And then they do this amazing thing called hibernation. They hold themselves up in a little nest, and they shut down to the point it's almost impossible to tell whether it's still alive or not. They can go without oxygen for up to an hour and a half if you're so willing to test it, a hedgehog in an airtight box, and still come out unharmed. Absolutely staggering work inside these hedgehogs. So there's a possibility that they're going into hibernation later and for shorter periods of time. The real threats that hedgehogs face are to do with what we describe as habitat fragmentation, where the suburban habitat where hedgehogs have taken up residence is becoming more fragmented because people are putting decking and patios in their gardens. They're paving over the front gardens to park their cars. They're putting up fences rather than having hedges so the hedgehogs can't move between gardens, that sort of thing. And in the rural setting, hedgehogs are suffering from habitat fragmentation because, well, hedgehogs aren't called hedgehogs on a whim. They hog the hedges. You know, that's their form of moving throughout the rural environment, is through the hedges. They're the motorways of that sort of ecosystem. And our hedges have been left to rack and ruin for decades now. So they're suffering from that. And also their food is being wiped out by intensive agriculture. It's not a happy time to be a hedgehog.
Can you tell us why you just went and got your first tattoo?
Probably my last tattoo as well. My wife thinks it is the perfect expression of a midlife crisis. I pointed out that this is surely better for me, our bank balance, and the hedgehogs, than maybe buying a sports car. There's an art project which has been taking place in Manchester in England called Extinct. It's Extinked. And it's a sort of social experiment marrying together artists, tattooists, and animal lovers. And what the artists have done is get 100 of the species from the UK's Biodiversity Action Plan. These are a list of species which are people are most concerned about. And then they've drawn an image for each of these. And then they said, here we go. Who wants to become an ambassador for everything from, obviously, the hedgehog, through other sort of more obvious and charismatic species like the red squirrel and the dormouse, all the way down to some pretty obscure plants, or the shrill carder bee, or what I love, the boring millipede. I mean, what a name for an animal, the boring millipede. They were absolutely overwhelmed with subscribers. Many, many, many hundreds of people were disappointed. And in fact, just this last weekend, we all got together in a gallery in Manchester, and over 4 days, there was a mass tattooing event. And I was the very first tattoo to be done, number one out of all 100. And my hedgehog now sits, it's a very cute little hedgehog too, just sits on my left leg above the ankle. And I think my wife, well, she let me into the house, let's put it that way. So she's accepting it.
It sounds almost like another lifetime marriage in a way, but you've already been working on it for 20 years for these spiny creatures.
Yes, I mean, I've never actually thought about having a hedgehog, a tattoo before. Though I have to say, I do reckon that part of the reason the entire process was passed relatively easily for me was that I have been handling very prickly animals. I have picked up hedgehogs thousands of times, and I'm sure that has in some way sort of immunized myself to the pain of lots of needles jabbing into my skin.
Really, that would be nothing for you. Well, there have been a lot of jokes and folklore about these creatures. We've got Sonic the Hedgehog and Mrs. Tiggy Winkle, or Kipling's Stickly Prickly. What are a couple of myths or stories about these creatures?
Oh, my goodness me. Now, I wrote a book about this. There are so many stories about hedgehogs, and that's one of the things I love about it, because they do attract that sort of attention. In fact, I did my very first, and I've been really pushing the boundaries of my comfort zones of late, because a couple of weekends before I got the tattoo, I did my first ever bit of hedgehog stand-up. And that was terrifying. I don't think I'm ever going to do that again. But it gave me an opportunity to tell lots of really bad hedgehog jokes. I mean, my favorite of which actually was, there was a joke which won an award recently, which is, you know, hedgehogs, why can't they just share the hedge? There's a comedian called Dan Antopolsky who came up with that one. But I was particularly fond of one which I sort of abused a chicken joke to make, which is, why did the hedgehog cross the road? The old joke, why did the hedgehog cross the road? To see its flatmate, because hedgehogs always getting squashed on the roads. I said, why did the hedgehog cross the road, jump up and down in the muddy puddle, and then run back again? Because there's a dirty double-crossing hedgehog. And I just thought, that's good. I like that one. So there's all that sort of line of it. But the sort of mythology which follows hedgehogs, it used to be that they were an animal of portent, an animal of the dark, an animal which is a bit secretive and a little bit scary. Many of the stories were quite disturbing. Until 1905, when Beatrix Potter, fed up with being abused by her male chauvinist colleagues, went off to give up science and write amazing stories. And since 1905, nearly every single hedgehog story has had the hedgehog as the very benign, well, everything from benign through to complete superhero sort of character. Principal ones, hedgehogs are covered in fleas. That's one of the ones I get all the time. And actually, I have very rarely met a flea-ridden hedgehog. And there are many reasons why people think they're covered in fleas, but it's principally the hedgehog you're most likely to see is one out in daylight, and a hedgehog out in daylight is poorly, and a poorly hedgehog can't groom itself properly, so it's probably going to have more parasites. So that's, yes, there are many, many, many stories out there, and I will. I can't really take up more of your time. I think you've got other people in your program.
Yep, we've got some more to go, so I really want to ask you, where can listeners find out more about hedgehogs, just as we wrap up here?
Okay, well, there's a number of different sites. My website is www.urchin.info, urchin, U-R-C-H-I-N. And from that, you can find links to the British Hedgehog Preservation Society, to the Hedgehog Welfare Society in the States, and begin to start getting an idea of where you can find more information. Also, a fairly eclectic and peculiar blog. I'm currently writing a piece all about my tattooing exploits, or rather, my being tattooed exploits. You'll get the lowdown on that as well, and also to consider whether my next book might result in another tattoo.
Ah, well, we'll look for that. So from England, we've been talking hedgehogs with Hugh Warwick, author of a book all about them. In Europe, look for A Prickly Affair, or in North America, The Hedgehog's Dilemma. Thank you so much, Hugh, for a look at this lovable creature.
Alex, a real pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, then. Radio EcoShock is picking up new stations. Welcome to new listeners from Whitehorse in the Yukon to Grand Rapids, Michigan. We're now syndicated to 20 stations, with more running the program intermittently, like Preston FM in Lancashire, England. Last week, the syndicated program Unwelcome Guests ran our recording of Smart Decline with Dr. Bill Reese, going out to another 21 radio stations.
I don't know how to tell the people to turn the radio back on if they turned it off, but I'm sure they'll figure it out.
After our broadcast of Prosperity Without Growth by Tim Jackson, our count on Feedburner showed the UK and Switzerland beating out the US listeners for a couple of days for the first time. Hello to our new Swiss listeners. Of course, we have regular downloaders from all over Europe, from the Philippines, Turkey, South Korea, Australia, India, Mexico, New Zealand, Russia, and too many others to name. Plus, literally thousands of downloads monthly from China, believe it or not. The total of last month's downloads from ecoshock.org was almost a terabyte. As a comparison, the famous Library of Congress fits in 3 terabytes. Of course, there's a lot more info in text than in audio, but a terabyte of green audio a month might make a difference. I want to thank all the blogs that have linked to Radio EcoShock. That really helps, too. If your local station doesn't carry Radio EcoShock, please email them asking for the program. Your requests can make it happen. It's already happened. Eventually, your neighbors will know the things that we find out here. every week. I also appreciate your tips and advice. Write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. For the half dozen people who heard our ocean special last week and then wrote in saying, well, one good solution is to stop eating meat, why don't I cover that? It's because I'm working on a meat-out program as cows, pigs, and sheep convert the atmosphere, bringing on climate disruption. We've got new reports on that. That's coming up. So much news coming out this week about the big climate convention in Copenhagen, Denmark. As we heard, the oil and power companies are cheering on the usual deniers, trying to pull out a last-minute November surprise before the climate summit with those leaked emails. I'm not surprised the mainstream media are pleased to announce the end of climate change. That's right, it was all a big hoax orchestrated by British scientists. Who can print that kind of garbage? We read that in a few feisty emails. Oh, jeez, what a relief. There's no climate change. Although I do recall the fire refugees running from the forest fires here last summer. The Australians haven't forgotten their fire dead. The Arctic ice is still thin, but hey, that's just a coincidence, we're told. The Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research has a new report out. They've found that the hole in the ozone layer hovering over the South Pole has cooled off Antarctica like a shield from global warming. Despite that, the air and sea temperatures around Antarctica are starting to rise. Warm water is speeding up. The West Antarctic ice sheet melt. Find a link to the full report in my blog.
It ain't pretty, and it could be dangerous.
The Global Carbon Project has found world CO2 emissions rose by 29% between 2000 and 2008. If that continues, Earth could experience 6 degrees centigrade of warming. That's where we're going without emergency action. More at globalcarbonproject.org or read Richard Black's excellent summary at the BBC News website. Despite impressive public support for climate action in Australia, their proposed carbon trading bill may be defeated by retrograde elements in the Senate. The opposition Liberal Party, which is very conservative, tossed out their leader, Malcolm Turnbull, who was going to vote with the new bill. The new leader, Tony Abbott, squeaked in with just one extra vote. Abbott is the right wing of the right wing, a super conservative Catholic and climate skeptic. If Prime Minister Kevin Rudd calls an election over the climate bill, that could be the end of the Liberal Party for a long time. After the big drought, the killer fires and the floods up north, most Australians have had enough of climate denial. UK journalist George Monbiot, author of the book Heat, has broken his self-imposed travel ban to go face the climate enemy. Well, that would be Canada, where another ultra-conservative, Stephen Harper, is gung-ho to support the dirty tar sands. Monbiot says Canada has become a major force in disrupting and blocking real climate agreements around the world. He writes, "Until now, I believe that the nation that has done most to sabotage a new climate agreement was the United States. I was wrong. The real villain is Canada. Unless we can stop it, the harm done by Canada in December 2009 will outweigh a century of good works." In 2006, the new Canadian government announced it was abandoning its targets to cut greenhouse gases under the Kyoto Protocol. No other country that had ratified the treaty has done this. Canada was meant to have cut emissions by 6% between 1990 and 2012. Instead, they have already risen by 26%. End quote from George Monbiot.
We know, I've said for a long time, we're not going to be able to achieve the Kyoto targets in Canada.
Last week at a meeting of the Commonwealth Nations, there was talk of kicking Canada out. Even the Queen came out with a message warning about the impacts of climate change. But Canada is hard at work upgrading its West Coast ports and pipelines, expecting that Obama's administration and public opinion will eventually kill off the American market. For our dirty tar oil, Canada is ramping up to sell it to Asia. The Port of Vancouver is plotting access for new Suez-class supertankers. Now the pipelines from Alberta have been doubled, with more in the works. The Canadian public appears to have fallen asleep by the roadside.
I'm here to stand up and be counted as one of the people who's really concerned about the climate crisis and particularly the lack of political action to do something about it, to do what I can to encourage the politicians, particularly Canadian politicians, to make the right moves in Copenhagen. The future of the world depends on it.
Climate action! Canadians first!
Climate action!
Canadians first!
Climate action!
Canadians first!
Climate action!
Meanwhile, a Canadian study group called the National Roundtable on the Environment and the Economy has a new report warning that Canadians' northern infrastructure will pay a heavy price in the warmer world. They say, quote, melting permafrost is undermining building foundations and threatens roads, pipelines, and communications infrastructure, it said in a report, also citing potential danger to energy systems, waste disposal systems, and ponds containing the toxic tailings from mines. That was written by Reuters. Well, to say nothing of the increased fires in the boreal forest and damaged animal life in the north, but who cares when there's money to be made? Come on, Canada, wake up. That's it for Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I appreciate you as a listener, wherever you are in the world. I try to earn your valuable time with every show. I claim no copyright on this, so pass it on to others, and let's do it again next week.